Stories from the East and West.
The American bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one of the most important and devastating events of the 20th century. Even though it happened more than 70 years ago, we can still feel its impact today.
The bombs brought World War II to an abrupt and decisive end. It was the first, and hopefully the last time, that a nuclear weapon was used in a conflict. It also marked the start of the Cold War arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union.
It's usually pretty depressing to talk about the bombs and their effects.
But what if we told you that there was some good that came from this dark day in history? That a speck of light shone through all this smoke and ash of destruction?
This light wasn't an event or a movement or anything like that. It was a man of great humanity and deep conviction.
For him, this was an unfortunate yet necessary call to action.
He would spend the rest of his life fighting the very thing he helped create. Hi, I'm Nitan.
And I'm John.
And you're listening to Stories from the Eastern West. In today's episode, we're going to tell you the inspiring story of nuclear physicist and peace activist Joseph Rotblat.
It's possible that you've never heard of him, but that's hardly your fault. He's become a bit of a historical footnote in the years since his death. But his contribution to this world? Well, that's hardly a footnote. And hopefully by the end of this episode, you'll understand why.
Born in 1908, Joseph Rotblat's first years of life were relatively comfortable, as his father was a successful businessman. They were by no means wealthy, but they were hardly poor.
But in 1914, 6 years after Rotblat's birth, war broke out across Europe, and this completely reversed the family's fortunes.
It was my experience during the First World War that shaped to a large extent my future. I had a terrible experience, complete privation during the First World War, hunger and cold and disease and witnessing death and so on, cruel things which have been happening.
That was the voice of Joseph Rotblat himself, taken from archival interviews. As he said, the war had a profound, formative impact on him. It was both a blessing and a curse.
And I, at that time, decided that I will not want to see any war once again. At the same time, maybe partly as trying to escape from reality, I began to read, quite at a young age, science fiction books, mostly Jules Verne's and others. And this fired my imagination and put me into the direction of trying to pursue science. And somehow, as a young child, I get the feeling that what I should do in my life is to make sure that science should help towards the prevention of the sort of thing which I lived through in my early childhood. In other words, the science should serve mankind, and with these enormous capabilities should be able to ensure peace for the world so people wouldn't have to go to war.
Though he had to endure extreme suffering and poverty, the war allowed him to realize something important about himself, something he may not have realized otherwise.
At least for Rotblat, the war allowed him to discover his passion for science. Yes, he saw that science was capable of great destruction. Think of all the scientific development that went into poison gas, explosive tanks, and so on and so forth. But he knew this wasn't the true purpose of science. Man had corrupted science, not the other way around.
Since his family was made poor by the war, he was ultimately unable to attend middle school and instead enrolled in a technical school, which he graduated from in 1923. He worked in Warsaw as an electrician for some time, but he didn't forget about his passion for science.
He decided to take entrance examinations for the Free University of Poland and was admitted to the physics department.
He then earned a master's degree and then a PhD, and in 1939 he moved to London to conduct research with James Chadwick, a physicist who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1935 for discovering the neutron.
Not long after moving to London, the Nazi invasion of Poland began. At the time, Rotblat's wife still lived in Poland while he worked in London. He desperately tried to help her escape Poland, but it proved to be impossible. The wartime environment made attempts like these completely unfeasible, even suicidal. Sadly, she was killed during the war, likely in a concentration camp.
This tragedy was something Rotblat hardly ever discussed during his life. It affected him deeply, and he never remarried.
If anything, though, it only managed to reinforce his hatred of war.
Let's fast forward to 1942, the year the Manhattan Project began. Here's Dr. Martin Sherwin, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. We talked to him to get a better understanding of what they were working on.
The Manhattan Project was a response to two things. In the first instance, the discovery of nuclear fission and the possibility that that discovery could lead to a weapon of some sort, a fantastic weapon of some sort. That was a possibility recognized very early, and certainly Rotblat was one of the first people to recognize that in 1939.
When the Manhattan Project was announced, Rotblat was still laboring away in Chadwick's laboratory in London. He wanted to return to Poland, but this was out of the question during the war.
But Rotblat wouldn't remain in England for long. In 1943, there was an agreement made between the Americans and the British called the Quebec Agreement, which, to put it simply, called for greater cooperation on scientific endeavors. Chadwick, Rotblat's boss, was named the head of the British mission to the Manhattan Project and was put in charge of selecting talented and reputable British scientists.
And Rotblat was one of the British scientists that Chadwick asked to be part of the British mission.
So the British went over to the United States without him, and 2 weeks later, he received a telegram from Chadwick, who respected Rotblat as a physicist very much and felt he was necessary for the British team. He received this telegram saying, pack your bags, we have made arrangements for you to come over. And what happened was that when Chadwick got to the United States, he convinced General Leslie Groves, the military officer in charge of the Manhattan Project, that Rotblat was absolutely necessary and could be, had to be brought over, even though he had Polish citizenship.
Even though he accepted Chadwick's invitation and began working at Los Alamos, he had strong reservations, as you would expect.
There was really only one reason why he joined the project, a reason that was shared by many of his fellow scientists.
Die Partei ist Hitler! Hitler aber ist Deutschland, wie Deutschland Hitler ist! Hitler, Sieg!
And I had in particularly in mind German scientists, because although by that time many of the physicists in Germany they had to go because of racial theories of Hitler, nevertheless, enough first-rate physicists were left in Germany who could have produced this sort of bomb if it were possible to do. And I was afraid that we knew that the war was going to come, that in such a case Hitler would not hesitate to make his scientists do it, carry out this work and use the bomb against us and then win the war.
But there was a moral dilemma he faced that never left his mind while he worked on the bomb.
I found myself in this terrible dilemma. On one hand, I felt this is something which I must not do, it's against all my principles. On the other hand, on the practical grounds, I felt this may be a threat to our civilization if the Nazis will win the war. And therefore gradually, sort of, in the course of the next few months, it wasn't immediately, that I begin to prepare, sort of work out a rationalization for my participating in this sort of work. Namely, I thought that the only way in which we may stop Hitler from using this bomb against us would be if we too had it and threatened with retaliation.
Despite this personal dilemma, he continued working on the project. He felt that it was the only thing he could do to protect civilization from the Nazis.
But then came a revelation.
Because it became clear to him, even in 1944, that Germany was not going to get a nuclear weapon, and that the bomb would not be ready in time to use against Germany.
The Germans began working on developing nuclear weapons before the war even began. But as the war became more demanding, their focus shifted elsewhere. Eventually, German interest in developing a nuclear device fizzled out.
For Rotblat, that was a deal-breaker. As he always said, it had been his sole motivation for working on the bomb. That motivation was now invalid. For him, there was no reason to stay.
The whole purpose of my being in Los Alamos was no longer there, and therefore I decided that I see no reason why I should go on. I felt I only started for what reason. This reason is no longer there. Therefore, to be consistent with my views, I ought no longer to work on the project. And therefore, I told Chad Whistler I wanted to leave.
So Rotblat, driven by his embattled conscience, began preparations to leave.
Rotblat was the only person who did it, and it was very complicated. Now, he was a member of the British delegation, not the American the American team, and that's the reason he was able to do it. And he went to Chadwick, who was the head of the British delegation, James Chadwick, and Chadwick was very upset. He said, this is going to cause a lot of problems. But there were a whole series of negotiations that finally permitted Rotblat to leave.
Yes, Rotblat would be the first and only person to leave the Manhattan Project. There were undoubtedly other scientists who shared his convictions, but he was the only one who simply couldn't bear associating himself with such a morally ambiguous undertaking.
But soon after he left, his worst fears became a disturbing reality.
August 6th, Japanese time, the first atomic bomb hit an enemy target.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT.
I have just returned from the White House, where it has just been announced that the United States is now using an atomic bomb, the most powerful explosive yet developed.
Almost 24 hours have passed since we first learned of the atomic bomb and its use against the city of Japan. And even now, after hearing many times the description of this new weapon, its capabilities continue to tempt human imagination. Our senses reel in staggering.
We run the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war.
Here's a building that was destroyed.
August 1945, two atomic weapons are dropped on Japan within days of one another. Rotblat was horrified.
And therefore, when I find out that it was used against the city with this terrible devastation, I was, of course, shocked. And all my worst fears about, which were told to me by Niels Bohr, came really vividly to me that this is now a new world, a world full of danger. Shall we survive now with these new weapons, now they have been used?
Upon seeing the destruction in Japan, Rotblat no longer wanted to participate in what he felt was destructive research. He believed science should only be used to help mankind, not destroy it. So, after leaving the United States, he took up a position at St. Bart's Hospital in London, where he began conducting research into medical physics. He remained there for the rest of his career.
But it was at St. Bart's that his anti-nuclear activism began. And it began with a discovery, an important one to say the least.
During the 1950s, several countries began conducting above-ground nuclear tests at various locations around the world.
1 March, 1954. 70 miles from the first shot of Operation Castle, a device with 1,000 times the energy of the bomb that shattered Hiroshima, exceeding the power of that bomb as vastly as it exceeded the greatest high-explosive giants of World War II. Multi-megaton weapons are here. Stockpile items as of today.
The recording you just heard was from the Castle Bravo nuclear test conducted in 1954 at Bikini Atoll, a small island in the Pacific Ocean. It was the largest ever conducted by the United States. And tests like these deeply worried Rotblat, so he began conducting research on the nuclear fallout that came from them.
While researching, he discovered a very, very disturbing detail. He uncovered that the amount of fallout initially believed to be released from the test had been severely underestimated. Dangerously underestimated, as a matter of fact.
Those of you who are old enough may possibly remember that in 1945, people were quite shocked by the atom bomb. Well, that seems now ancient history, and we think of the atom bomb as something like bows and arrows. We advanced on from that to the H-bomb, which was very much worse than the atom bomb. And then it turned out, first I think through the detective work of Professor Rotblat and afterwards by the admission of the American authorities, that the bomb that was exploded at Bikini was very much worse than an H-bomb. The H-bomb now is ancient history.
Does that voice sound familiar? I'm sure you've heard of the speaker, though. It was the famous British philosopher Bertrand Russell. He comes into play in a minute. So, after Rotblat's startling findings were published, it was also discovered that many people all over the world had been inadvertently exposed to dangerous amounts of nuclear fallout.
While his findings were incredibly distressing, they were also of great importance and timing. The public became more aware of the true nature of these tests thanks to his discovery. More importantly, his findings sparked much-needed public debate on the safety of these tests.
In the end, these debates culminated in the signing of the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963. Remembering the name of this treaty isn't important. What is important is what it accomplished, namely banning all above-ground and underwater nuclear tests.
Since it was signed, it has played a vital role in decreasing the amount of radioactive material in our atmosphere.
After this monumental discovery, Rotblat became one of the more prominent critics of nuclear weapons and the arms race, both inside and outside of the scientific community. People praised his research as well as his outspoken views on nuclear weapons.
In a short period of time, he became a well-respected member of the anti-nuclear community. In 1955, he was the youngest person invited to sign the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, named after the philosopher Bertrand Russell and, of course, Albert Einstein. Here's Bertrand Russell himself talking about the importance of the manifesto.
The accompanying statement, which has been signed by some of the most eminent scientific authorities in different parts of the world, deals with the perils of a nuclear war. It makes it clear that neither side can hope for victory in such a war, and that there is a very real danger of the extermination of the human race by dust and rain from radioactive clouds.
And Russell himself realized that merely warning people of the dangers of nuclear weapons and war in general was not enough. So he proposed
an international congress of men of science from all scientific countries.
Yes. Russell called for the establishment of a conference that would bring together scientists and public figures from around the world to find solutions to a variety of international issues, especially those concerning nuclear weapons.
The first conference became a reality a few years later in 1957 in Pugwash, Nova Scotia. Named after its first setting, they would be called the Pugwash Conferences on Science and World Affairs.
Here's Dr. Sherwin on their importance.
Well, in my opinion, Pugwash was a very, very important movement and something that was extremely influential in terms of foundational relationships between the United States and the Soviet Union as they moved from confrontation to nuclear agreements.
Rotblat himself became heavily involved in these conferences. Along with Bertrand Russell and several other public figures, he helped organize the first conference in 1957, and he remained involved in them until his death, even serving as Secretary General of the conferences for almost 20 years.
Most importantly, it was for his work on Pugwash that he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1995. Upon learning of the award, he requested that it be received jointly with the conference itself. So the 1995 prize was awarded to Rotblat and the Pugwash conferences.
The Nobel Prize Committee gave the following reasons.
for their efforts to diminish the part played by nuclear arms in international politics and, in the longer run, to eliminate such arms.
Rotblat's acceptance speech was passionate.
What we are advocating in Pagos, a war-free world, will be seen by many as a utopian dream. It is not utopian. There already exist in the world large regions, for example the European Union, within which war is inconceivable. What is needed is to extend these to cover the world's major powers.
The Pugwash conferences are arguably Rotblat's crowning achievement. They laid the groundwork for several important treaties that have helped make the world a safer place.
The conferences showed that cooperation on normally divisive issues was possible, after all, and that a nuclear-free world was within reach.
But there was another issue that troubled Rotblat, an issue that had troubled him from a very young age. It echoed throughout the anti-nuclear work he had done, namely man's exploitation of science.
It's a problem that haunted him all his life. It drove him to conduct research on nuclear fallout, it drove him to signing the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, and it drove him to establishing the Pugwash conferences. For Rotblat, the exploitation of science was one of the greatest threats to humanity.
In Rotblat's eye, nuclear and atomic scientists had often failed to consider the repercussions of their research. This negligence had led to catastrophes like the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For him, scientists could no longer afford to be negligent.
Scientist has this responsibility, this social responsibility, to be aware of the implications of the work he's doing and, if need be, to inform public and politicians and warn them about possible dangers. And I believe that this has become particularly strong since the war years, as the threat of science and technology, not only science, is becoming more and more imminent.
For this reason, Rotblat proposed an idea that you might have heard of. Well, sort of. It was called the Hippocratic Oath for Scientists.
Now, you've probably heard about the Hippocratic Oath for medical doctors, where they all have to promise to uphold certain ethical standards. The Hippocratic Oath for Scientists basically takes this logic and applies it to, well, you know, scientists. Take a listen to what Rotblat came up with.
I promise to work for a better world, where science and technology are used in socially responsible ways. I will not use my education for any purpose intended to harm human beings or the environment. Throughout my career, I will consider the ethical implications of my work before I take action. While the demands placed upon me may be great, I sign this declaration because I recognize that individual responsibility is the first step on the path to peace.
But even though the oath sounds wonderful, it was never actually implemented in any formal sense.
I don't think it was ever something that could be adopted universally, since it essentially argued that physicists, scientists cannot participate in bomb making and, you know, war related activities. And a huge proportion of the science community during the Cold War was related in one way or another with those kinds of activities.
In other words, it wasn't realistic. You couldn't just tell scientists what to do, nor could you try to tell their governments what to do. It was the Cold War. Nuclear research was non-negotiable.
So, to this day, the Hippocratic Oath for Scientists is still an idea. It has its problems, there's no denying that, but Rotblat may have been onto something. Maybe this is exactly what the scientific community needs, a reminder of the true purpose of their research. Science has the remarkable potential to improve humanity, but it can still be manipulated and exploited. Maybe an oath of this sort, it doesn't necessarily have to be the one Rotblat proposed, will protect us from the many horrors the world witnessed throughout the 20th century.
Yes, the 20th century was a difficult one, and Rotblat saw nearly all of it. You'd think that seeing all this death, destruction, and violence would give most people little reason to be optimistic. It's easy to think that mankind is kind of a lost cause, and that we'll never learn from our mistakes.
And as for Rotblat, he too had little reason to be optimistic. He saw both world wars, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the entirety of the Cold War, genocide, terrorism, and so on. But the amazing thing is that his optimism never wavered. His love of humanity never faded.
And if you think about it, many of his warnings often went ignored, and many of his efforts often went unnoticed. But again, this didn't discourage him. He believed wholeheartedly that the risk of nuclear warfare was a finite one. And for him, if a risk was finite, it could be reduced, even if it proved to be immensely difficult.
In fact, Rotblat's activism never diminished as he grew older. If anything, old age made him more vocal about the dangers of nuclear weapons. And this continued until his death in 2005 at the age of 96.
96. So, after hearing Rotblat's story, you might be thinking to yourself, why don't we learn about this guy in school? Why isn't he a more widely known figure? And you know, it's a shame. Much of his work did technically go on behind the scenes, but that hardly takes away from his remarkable contribution to mankind. But it's not just schools that fail to talk about him. It's also the physics community itself, his own people.
Young physicists really do not know the history of their professional fathers and grandfathers, the Oppenheimers, the Tellers, it's a pity, but it's a profession that looks to the present and the future, and the work that they are doing now, rather than the work that was done over the course of, you know, the last century that created the environment they're working in today.
But you know, in the end, I don't think he would mind this. I don't think he cared if he was remembered. He never went about trying to make a name for himself. It was always about his message. It was the message that truly mattered. If anything, Joseph Rotblat would have wanted us to remember what he stood for and the message he fought his whole life to spread. A message beautifully put into words in the final lines of his Nobel Prize acceptance speech.
The quest for a war-free world has a basic purpose: survival. But if in the process we learn how to achieve it by love rather than by fear, by kindness rather than by compulsion, if in the process we learn to combine the essential with the enjoyable, the expedient with the benevolent, the practical with the beautiful, this will be an extra incentive to embark on this great task. Above all, remember your humanity.
This episode of Stories from the East and West was a Wirewalker studio production for Culture.pl. Our team included Wojciech Olekszak, Adam Żuławski, John Beecham, Nitzan Reisner, and Michael Keller. A big thanks to Dr. Martin Sherwin for joining us on this episode. To see the notes from this episode, just tap the show art in your podcast app or visit storiesfromtheeastandwest.com. If you enjoyed the show, make sure to subscribe for future episodes and remember to give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It'll help others find the podcast too.